idea that religion and politics don't mix was invented by the devil to keep Christians from running their own country.
Catapult of propaganda.
The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody, and welcome to the bunker. It's Monday. It's a glorious day here in the St. Louis area, and it's one more day till my mother's birthday.
And that's really what matters.
I know all of you have that on your calendar. You've probably already done your birthday
shopping.
That's
right. And your mom rocks.
She does. Mom is the coolest gal.
She is. She is.
And she tells me many times that if I don't take care of Derek, she will take him away from me.
And
she could.
if she put her mind to it. No, that's not true.
Well, I mean, as far as being a gorgeous woman.
But, yes, I can see where you get your looks.
You're wonderful. So,
and she's a sweetheart. She raised her daughters right. There's no question about that. Well, we thank you for joining us today. This week, Prophecy Series continues with Dave Week.
It's the Dave Show, starring them. They're Dave.
It's the week of Daves. We got David Duncan tonight, and we begin a three-part interview with him. And then on Thursday and Friday, we have David Flynn, who's, between these two fellas, if your brain doesn't expand a couple of sizes this week in their interpretations of what lies ahead, then, there's just no hope for you, because it's interesting stuff, and it is really, again, two more fresh perspectives, we think, on end time prophecy.
That's right. And just in case of the brain, you know, expansion, buy new hats.
Well,
buy a hat that's at least two sizes too big.
We'll balance things out, so don't worry. We'll lower the average IQ back down to a manageable level.
Oh, actually, that's probably true. Just get a hat that's got a sort of one of those little expando things on it, like those Sansibel pants or whatever they are.
That's right.
Ah, Sansibel.
Yeah. Well, we got a couple of interesting notes to start off with tonight. First of all, we need to point out that Barry Chamish has had a brush with mortality very recently.
He has
sent out a note to his mailing list. And in fact, as we were interviewing Peter Goodgame last night, Peter, after we were done, mentioned that he'd not heard from Barry in some weeks and was a little concerned. And this morning, Barry sent out a note to his mailing list and said that it's, he's basically been away from the computer for the past 3 weeks because he suffered a head-on collision in his car driving home from Jerusalem on Independence Day. Of course, that would be the Independence Day for Israel.
Right.
So he said he basically lost about 4 days worth of his life, doesn't remember anything except for about 8 minutes in the ambulance. But
honestly, that's a blessing.
Probably so. I imagine if he did remember most of the 4 days, it would have been just lots and lots of pain.
Mm-hmm.
Because it sounds like he was in pretty bad shape. His body was punctured through the chest, and in fact, he was down to like one lung still functioning, and very near death. So he's recuperating now, but and the police have yet to solve the accident. They don't know who the other driver is at this point, and that's a little unusual. If it's a head-on collision, sufficient to put one of the drivers into critical condition.
Yeah, you wouldn't think that the other car would be able to just speed away.
Exactly. So we asked for your prayers for Barry Chamish, and it appears that he may be considering a move from Israel.
Well, you know, actually, he mentioned that when we talked with him
right.
A couple of months ago, that he was beginning to think that the politics in Israel
mm-hmm.
were turning sour.
Right.
He was ready to leave town.
And not just for his own safety. He's got children there that are of an age where they are going to have to serve in the military soon, and he doesn't agree with the way the military there is being used. So
mm-hmm.
That's something that he's dealing with now. And, of course, you can see his latest updates at his website, BarryChamish.com. Another gentleman who's well-known in the, I don't know if you want to say conspiracy community, but one who was known as a real gadfly, I guess, by the powers
that
be.
Well, we used to read a lot.
Yes, yes, and hosted a radio program similar to this. It was broadcast via the internet called Cloak and Dagger with Lenny Bloom. Sherman Skolnick passed away over the weekend at the age of 73, according to Channel 2, which is a CBS affiliate in Chicago. He died in his sleep over the weekend. He was hosting, in addition to the Cloak and Dagger radio program, he was hosting a cable television show in the Chicago area called Broadside. So apparently passed away quietly in his sleep, and if you're going to go, that's the way to go. But Sherman Skolnick certainly was one who came out with some of the more, spectacular stories in the alternative media. And he's a name that people who have been researching the underside of political corruption in this country for years certainly know the name of Sherman Skolnick.
You know, it's really interesting because also in the last 48 hours, we've lost Dr. Lee Jong-wook, who was the head of the World Health Organization. And he especially, I think, came to prominence during the SARS epidemic because he was in charge of that.
Right. Right. He was age 61, so I don't know.
Well, it's relatively young. I mean, that, and I know that you can have a lot of things that happen even in your 40s and 50s, but I think 61 is about 30 years shy of a full life.
Well, in today's medicine, and especially when you're head of the World Health Organization,
you would think so.
You'd think you'd have the best care. But he is no longer among us, and I guess that's as good a place as any to lead into our first news item from over the weekend, and one that's got to have people in the UK a bit on edge tonight. And that is a story that a woman who was working in the British Embassy in Lesotho, which is a small kingdom in Africa, returned home on a flight over the weekend and died apparently from Ebola.
Can you believe that? Now, Ebola is a very nasty disease. It has a very low survival rate.
We had talked about this during the outbreak of the Marburg virus in Angola last spring.
Because it's similar.
Right. They're both hemorrhagic fevers, which basically means your blood vessels begin to leak and you bleed out. And the case fatality rate for Ebola is very high, not as high as the Marburg outbreak in Angola was displaying, which was nearly 100%.
Yeah.
But it is still very high and very quick. She got on the plane, apparently was feeling ill, but she was allowed to continue on the flight. Well, she passed out during the flight from Africa back to the UK and was rushed to the hospital upon arrival at Heathrow Airport, died in the hospital over the weekend, not long after getting to Heathrow. And, of course, the passengers and crew on that flight are very, very nervous, as well as the people that they've come in contact with since then.
Oh, exactly. I mean, we're talking about a very closed environment. We just saw in the news a few weeks ago how a couple of people who had been exposed to and developed measles, mumps, passed it around to the people on the 9 flights that they shared. And because of that, supposedly, and I do mean supposedly, because of that, we have mumps outbreak in the Midwest.
Yep. This is the kind of scenario that we were talking about with Angola. And one of the reasons we were so concerned that the Western media was paying no attention to the Marburg virus outbreak. There is an international airport in Angola. Thankfully, nobody got onto a plane and carried it to the West. But this was, and we haven't heard anything about the chikungunya virus.
No.
The outbreak of chikungunya.
No, exactly.
After, was it Dominique de Villepin came back with a mosquito bite from his visit.
And he was afraid he might have it.
Right. So we are seeing now an example here, and we don't know if this will spread in the UK. We don't know if anyone else has been diagnosed with it or not. But this is how it could spread. Somebody in an infected area, in this case coming from Lesotho, gets on a plane at an international airport and flies to a crowded city, say a Hong Kong or a Mexico City or a Tokyo or a New York or London, you know, only a day or two sick, but still shedding virus. And suddenly you've got hundreds, perhaps thousands of people infected. So this is a story that we'll keep an eye on in London because, again, you had the people who were on the plane that had to deal with her while she was sick, vomiting, and any bodily fluid actually would contain virus, even sweat. So that's really, really a scary situation for them.
Well, I'm also looking, since you said that, I decided to go to Google News and just do a quick search for chikungunya. And apparently it is showing up. It had shown up in India, but there were, you know, really just one or two cases. But apparently Mangalore now has six cases.
Mm. So it's spreading around the Indian Ocean, the rim of the Indian Ocean.
It looks like it is,
yeah. Switching to geopolitical news, this was a story that was...
Well, before we leave that, I want to bring attention to this disease that is called Kala-Azar.
Oh, okay, good. I'm glad you mentioned that.
And it's apparently a disease that is... Kala-Azar is a Hindi word, and it means black death. Hmm. Now, you and I associate Black Death with the plague.
Right.
But apparently this is affecting an area in southern Sudan that is being ignored by most of the white, prominent, rich folks in the world.
Right.
Yeah, we see this over and over again. Again, if you haven't seen The Constant Gardener, go watch that movie. Says here, the sickness starts with a bite of a tiny sand fly and mutates quickly from there into chills, fever, then an onslaught of black lesions that will most likely prove fatal within 6 months without treatment. Now, let me just say, the reason the plague was called the Black Death was because, and the reason it was called the bubonic plague is because there was a lesion that was called a bubo that was at the site of the bite of a flea from a rat. It was a particular parasite on the rat that carried this disease, carried a bacterial infection within it, and the parasite was sick, and so it would regurgitate on the, I know this sounds gross, but as it bit, it regurgitated the infection into the person's bloodstream, the person that it was biting, or the rat that it was biting. And that's how it got. And it turned, because it necrotized or killed the flesh around it, the flesh around the bite turned black.
Okay.
And so when I see a story about chills, fever, then black lesions, this sounds really scary.
It, yeah, it does. And again, because it's affecting people that aren't Caucasian. It is getting very little attention in the West, and you can see why the news report from South Africa is calling this a neglected disease. Well, that sadly is the way the world tends to work. Things that are of primary importance in Africa, such as dealing with malaria, Ebola, hemorrhagic fevers, Marburg, don't really take on a whole lot of importance here in the West until somebody shows up at Heathrow Airport or JFK or O'Hare or Hartsfield or LAX.
And here's another tinfoil hat time. And we recently got an email. What's this tinfoil hat you keep putting on? We just assumed everybody knows. If you don't, go watch the movie Signs. The fact is, we were wearing tinfoil hats before Signs ever came out, because it was based on a website we saw many, many years ago where a gentleman claimed that aluminum foil would keep the aliens from reading your thoughts.
Yeah, and he gave instructions on how to make it properly. So
he did. So, yeah, of course, I have all kinds of little hats, some with flowers, some with not. And but anyway, this of course, is kind of out there, but what if you are a developed nation and you see a small, poor nation with lots of oil and some corrupt leaders? Boy, if you could just get that land. Oh, there are a lot of people on the land. Boy, if those people just weren't there.
Yeah, it's bad politics these days to just go in and invade. That kind of went out at the middle of the last century.
Yeah.
So the whole colonialism thing isn't politically correct anymore. So you use a targeted virus of some sort. Perhaps delivered by an aerosol, perhaps an infected parasite of some sort, a mosquito perhaps.
Perhaps part of a vaccine.
Or perhaps delivered in a vaccine or as part of a drug trial.
These are just really nasty thoughts, but the fact is that there are parts of Africa, Nigeria for one, the Sudan. Is that another one that has a lot of oil?
Darfur. Because,
Darfur. Yeah. Hey, folks. These people have nothing. Mm-hmm. The only thing they have is a little patch of land.
Yep. And somebody in the West with a few bucks in his pocket decides he wants it. More often than not, history shows that he's going to get it. Mm-hmm. And sadly, he'll find somebody there to collaborate with him in helping him get it. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget that the slave trade, as vile and evil as it was and still is, could not have been accomplished, could not have been carried out without the assistance of some of the tribes in Africa assisting the slave traders.
Well, I'm afraid that that goes way back because people, white, black, brown, yellow, mm-hmm. red, doesn't matter what your color is, doesn't matter what your religion is, way too many people, if their backs are against the wall, they'll sell out their grandma.
Well, you know, it took me a long time to understand what Jesus meant when he said, "The poor you will always have with you." I thought, at the time that I first heard that scripture as a kid, well, that's a real defeatist attitude. I mean, you know, John F. Kennedy said, you know, I look at things and wonder why not. You know, ask not what your country can do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It took me a long time to realize that Jesus had an understanding, has an understanding of the human heart that is unsurpassed. It's not because people are always, that there will always be lazy people or there will always be people who, that it's just too big a problem and we as humans can never get a grip on it. It's because poor people are the result of a few people who are greedy, mm-hmm. who are pursuing the love of money to the exclusion of everything else. Mm-hmm. Poor people are created because wealthier people are taking more than what they need. And that is the problem. That mm-hmm. is why we will always have the poor with us.
Now, mind you, we are not advocating communism.
No. I also believe
human government won't solve the problem.
Exactly. No, I also believe very strongly that Paul was right when he said, "They that won't work, neither let them eat."
Exactly.
So, that's the bottom line.
Well, before we get to our fabulous guest, David Duncan, there are a couple of other stories I want to make sure we mention.
Yes.
One of them is this whole thing in Afghanistan.
Talking
Did you
about,
see that story?
Yeah. Another area in the world where the people don't have much but a patch of land. And there have been the big powers fighting over this now for the last 30. Well, going back to the days of the British Empire. It's been going on 150 years now.
Oh, going back to Greece. Alexander wanted Afghanistan.
Well, that's true. He did, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and these poor people have just been, you know, kind of going with the flow and letting one invading army after another take over. Of course, we're the current, you know, occupying army of the month here in the United States. The Telegraph over the weekend has published a story that is just unbelievable
in
its implications.
It's just not getting talked about at all. And to me,
no,
this is huge.
This is huge. According to their sources, the Telegraph in the UK reports that American defense officials have secretly requested a quantity of ammunition from Russia, and we're talking a huge quantity of ammunition from Russia.
A quantity that would supply the British Army for 15 years.
We're talking 78 million rounds of AK-47 ammunition, 100,000 rocket-propelled grenades, 12,000 tank shells. That's equivalent.
$400 million worth of armament.
400 big ones. And the Telegraph sources say that when Russian military leaders received this request from the United States government through back channels, they, quote, fell about laughing, end quote, because they thought it was a joke.
They did, and who wouldn't think it was a joke? Apparently, again, according to the Telegraph and their sources, the United States administration, currently in office, just in case Democrats take over, has decided that Afghanistan must be protected. So they have to receive arms. And, of course, the United States can't send them over there. That looks wrong. But we can give $400 million to Russia for them.
Now,
think about this, folks.
The implications of this are mind-numbing. First of all, do you really believe that the leading Democratic candidate for president as of now, Hillary Clinton, is any less warlike than George W. Bush or any other Republican candidate in 2008? If anything, she sounds more hawkish than George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to John Kerry's, go back and look at John Kerry's words from the last campaign. He was not advocating pulling out of Iraq or Afghanistan. If anything, he said, we're just not doing it right. We need more guys in there.
No.
The Democrats and the Republicans are on the same team.
Two faces, same coin.
Yes. So that can't be it. What
so
is the deal?
Why are we giving $400 million to Russia to arm the Afghanistan people?
Could this be considered, perhaps, a bribe to keep the Russians out of our business when we go into Iran?
Could be. Let's see. Look the other way, and you can have the country you wanted all along.
That's the other thing. If...
Because think about it. Russia wants Afghanistan. Oh, we're so sorry. The AK-47s we sent out, they're not working. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, maybe you should have given them more of those Stinger missiles you gave them when our troops were being shot down by them. The irony of this is just astounding. Well, no, maybe irony is not the right word. Maybe chutzpah. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. The fact is that one of the main reasons... one of the main reasons...
Excuse me while I clean up my screen.
That's right. It's been spackled. One of the main reasons the Russians were driven out of Afghanistan were the Stinger missiles that we provided, the Taliban...
Yes.
...which were used to shoot down Russian helicopters and Russian troop transports.
I know. This is insanity. Of course, mind you, we are wanting to go into Iran, and Afghanistan is right on the border of Iran. The other thing to remember, folks, looking at prophecy, and of course mm-hmm. that's what we've been doing now for the last few weeks, there are many who believe that the Kingdom of the North, the uttermost North that invades Israel, Gog and Magog, mm-hmm. that is Russia.
Right.
And if that is true, Russia will most likely come through Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you have to go through Afghanistan to get to Turkey?
No.
No.
No, you'd go through Georgia and Azerbaijan.
Ah, those two countries don't like Russia right now.
No, they don't.
They're both cheesed at Russia.
Georgia used to be part of Russia. They didn't like it, or mm-hmm. the Soviet Union anyway.
Exactly.
That was one of those color-coded revolutions that you know, was a popular uprising paid for by George Soros with money from the U.S. Department of State. Yeah.
Okay,
so
if you
anyway.
Want to vote for this guy, hold up a banana. That was going on in Africa. They were, for those who didn't see, seriously, they gave them fruit. And, okay, what'd she want? The fruit?
And that could come in handy when the results are over and you don't like the way things are going.
If we only had that here.
Yes. We've saved the fruit from the election 6 months ago. It's just about ready.
Let me just say, no more tomato-colored ballots.
Yes. So we've got a $400 million arms deal for Afghanistan, allegedly.
Allegedly?
Yeah, that would
That's
certainly
assuming
be...
assuming anything is given in exchange for that money. That money may mean nothing more than...
Keep out of Iran while we go
yes.
in. The question I would like to ask is whether if these arms are truly going to be moved to Afghanistan, if we're going to use the same airline run by Viktor Bout, the Russian arms dealer, who happened to lose, managed to lose, 4 plane loads worth of AK-47s that were supposed to go to Iraq.
No, seriously, I had them. They were right here. I don't know. It's a bookkeeping error, I think.
Yeah, it's misplaced.
It's sort of like that plutonium that's missing from...
Los Alamos. Well, a little closer to home, we've got an article coming out in the June 2006 issue of Popular Mechanics that's worth taking note. And Sharon posted and this was supplied to us, sent to us by a listener who goes by Seeking Truth, and we thank you for this tip. It's kind of frightening because the Popular Mechanics article deals with police tactics that are effective in mm-hmm. fighting terrorism. In fact, the slug at the top, the slug line at top says, here's a look at who's doing it right.
Yeah.
And then you see a picture of these two black-clad, armored, automatic weapons carrying New York police officers.
And notice, here's the thing. You really have to go to watchermagazine.com and take a look at this story. We'll link to it in the show notes, or Derek mm-hmm. will. Take a look at this. This picture could easily have come out of World War II. Look at the way they're dressed.
Yeah.
Look at the angle of the shot to make it seem even more intimidating, mm-hmm. and it's in black and white.
Yep.
I didn't change the color on that, folks. That was how it was on the Popular Mechanics site. That's how the photo was done originally.
Look at the shape of the helmets.
Yes.
Isn't
this
it interesting?
This is intended to look very menacing.
The helmets that are being used by this unit. This is a unit, an anti-terrorist unit, that's called the Hercules unit. And their tactic, and we, in fact, there was a story that came out of Miami some months ago that we talked about that was similar to this. This unit pulls up to a building downtown Manhattan, in a black unmarked Chevy Suburban. They hop out, dressed in black, wearing body armor and helmets that look like they came up from the German army in World War II,
mm-hmm.
and carrying automatic weapons, submachine guns, snub-nosed shotguns. They basically jump out of this Chevy Suburban, no sirens, no lights, just these guys dressed in black carrying automatic weapons, mm-hmm. jumping out and running into a bank. Hut, 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 hut.
Yes.
The intention is to just scare the spit out of people. It is really disturbing. But mm-hmm. they believe that this is how they're going to fight terrorism in the United States.
Because you never know when they're going to show up.
Now,
I wasn't expecting them.
Yeah. Like the Spanish Inquisition. This is really bizarre, if you ask me, because my thinking is this. If I'm a professional terrorist, I mean, somebody who's really planning to do something nasty to the United States, is this going to deter me from doing my job?
No.
The fact that these guys are just showing up unannounced on Wall Street, on Fifth Avenue, wherever, just making a very public display of running around with automatic weapons, is that going to stop me from doing what I want to do?
Not at all.
No.
And most especially if you happen to be there when it happens, and I'll tell you why. Because one of the things, and this is Doug Hageman who mm-hmm. says this, and so I tip my hat to him. I tip my tinfoil hat to him. Very often, alarms will be given, you know, a fire or a school, you know, or mm-hmm. whatever, simply because the terrorists want to watch the responders,
mm-hmm.
see where the responders go afterward,
mm-hmm.
where they're keeping these vehicles, where they keep these, you know, the accoutrement that they
right.
wear, and more than that, when they get in their cars and go home.
Right.
Where these guys live.
Exactly. So I think then if the point is not to scare away potential terrorists by just showing up unannounced at random locations, what then is the true... Because I can't believe that professional law enforcement agents haven't thought this through a lot better than you and I.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you know, we're fairly intelligent, but we're not law enforcement professionals. But if we can figure out that this isn't going to stop a dedicated, mm-hmm. committed terrorist who's not afraid to die, in fact, looks forward to it.
Oh, precisely.
Then what is the real purpose of these guys showing up with their guns and their body armor? They look like stormtroopers. What's the purpose? Who are they trying to intimidate? The answer? Me and you.
Precisely.
Me and you. And this is really disturbing. And again, the tone of the article in Popular Mechanics. Here's a look at one unit that's doing it right.
Mm-hmm.
Should we point out that the chief research editor for Popular Mechanics is Benjamin Chertoff?
Chertoff?
Yes, that Chertoff. First cousin to the Secretary of Homeland Security. You need to take a look at this, read the article, and take a look at the picture because it's PSYOPs. And it is not, I can't believe, unless somebody can explain this to me in a way that will help me to understand, I just can't believe that this is doing anything in the war on terror.
It's doing nothing. But you know what? Speaking of PSYOPs, we had a wonderful conversation with David Duncan.
Ah, good segue.
And he has been taking a look at the PSYOPs here in the United States and how it relates to Christians.
Dave Duncan is one of the most original thinkers that we've run across when it comes to putting together end time prophecy and also relating it to what the New Age and occult movements are teaching about the coming end of days.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go right to that interview, part one, with David Duncan.
One of the most interesting websites you'll find on the internet is the NewWorldOrderScam.com, and its owner, operator, proprietor, and author is Dave Duncan. Dave, welcome back to PID Radio.
Well, thank you, Derek.
You know, Derek, we're so glad to have you back. Derek, we're glad to have you back. Dave, you know, we've been praying for you. We know you had a few health issues, and we're just glad that you're doing okay and that you're up to doing the interview with us. But more than that, after your last interview, we had lots and lots of email, people who really appreciated your point of view, but more than that, that you're coming from a very unique perspective.
Yeah,
you hung out with some interesting people.
Different background.
Exactly. We've got listeners to our show now that have never heard you, though. And rather than go through the entire story that you told us when you were on last year, because they can listen to you in the archives, can you just really briefly give us a little bit of your background that gives you a unique perspective on biblical prophecy?
Yeah, sure. Well, I was a hippie back in 1966 and 67, and I lived in Haight-Ashbury for a couple of years, and we all lived in a commune, and we had a guru that was the leader of that commune by the name of Alan Noonan, and that man, I think, knows more about the plan, the occult plan for the end of the age than any individual that I've ever met. And so my first website was primarily geared to expositing what I learned from him. And I think there are some things that I had learned from him that I have not seen published. And there's been so much published about this that in itself is interesting, that some of his things have escaped being published. And so I went ahead and published all of the memories that I have about his concepts of how the plan will be realized. And that was my first website.
Now, would you have considered yourself a spiritual man when you were a hippie?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think at that point in time, I was convinced in my heart that comprehension of spiritual realities would be facilitated by taking LSD. So I took huge amounts of it.
Opening
the door. Changed my opinion about that since that point in time, but I think a lot of us were had a strong spiritual impulse to comprehend what this is all about.
So it was opening the doors, like as Aldous Huxley put it.
Yes, right.
The doors of perception. Yeah. So your first website again, newworldorderscam.com, and you've got a new page now, or a postscript, if you will, the year 2012 scam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, we all try to assemble our ideas about what reality consists of from our experiences in life and what we read and what we see. And I'd like to share some of my life experiences, two of them in particular, that have strongly shaped my views about reality.
Okay.
I know that I've studied conspiracy literature for, oh, heck, I don't know, 25 years, and I've seen quite a bit of it. I've read quite a few books that strongly tell us that the conspiracy is a Jewish one, and I've really come to take issue with that.
Dave, before you get too far into this, I want to just make a point of what you do for a living.
Yeah, I'm a chemist.
You're a chemist, so you approach life from a scientist's viewpoint.
Yes, I try to.
So you're not easily persuaded?
No, well, I try not to be, but you know, that's one of the problems in this whole field of endeavor, to try to understand what's going on. There's so much information out there. Mm-hmm. It is hard to sift and sort what's worth keeping from what's not.
It is. It is. I just want to make that point so people who are not familiar with you know that you don't just read anything and everything and swallow it whole cloth. You really do test things out.
Well, I think one of the tests of the conspiracy literature was determined for me by the fact that I knew some years back some people in the billionaire class, and I'm not using the word billionaire loosely, they really, truly were. And they have a family history that is intimately tied back to Bohemian Grove, and these connections for that family go back to the latter half of the 19th century. We traveled frequently to New York and Washington, D.C. and Houston, and we dined in the finest of restaurants. And from our conversations over the span of 15 years, while I was employed by them, I learned to know them quite intimately as people. And these people up there in the stratosphere have a burning hatred of the Jewish people, and there just simply isn't any other way to describe it. In 1982, I made it known that I had become a Christian. And during the next few years, I gently suggested that maybe they should have a heart for the Jewish people. So my employment wound up kind of soon after that. But the lesson learned was that the level of Jew hatred was just at a fever pitch or a spiritual or satanic level among these people. So this shaped my conclusions about billionaire families in the Bohemian Grove, these folks were definitely Gentiles. And I should also mention that there were a lot of Vatican connections, too, that were there in their comfort zone.
Dave, may I ask you a quick question? These people that you were hanging out with when you were employed there, the billionaire types, mm-hmm. did they speak openly of Bohemian Grove? Is that why you know that they were part of it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, they published a book that was a family history that openly discussed the membership in Bohemian Grove.
Oh.
Interesting.
We'll have to have a chat just about that sometime.
Yeah, that's a rabbit hole that goes down pretty deep.
Yes, it is.
I've had to try to reconcile this knowledge that I've gained from experience knowing these people with the idea that is so often presented that the Jews are the conspiracy, and it just doesn't jive. It just doesn't square with reality, at least as far as I've been able to see. And on the front page of my 2012 scam website, I mentioned Greg Szymanski's interview with a person named Joanna, and she struck me as having a level of sincerity that made her pretty hard to dismiss. And I'd like to repeat some quotations from her that were published at Rents.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Specifically, Anna said her role within the religious sector of the Illuminati had to do with an extremely devious Illuminati ploy creating a false Christianity leading to mass genocide. Again, quote, "My huge area of concern is an extremely deceptive ploy by both the Illuminati and the core Vatican cult members to unite all people under a false Christianity that will give reason for genocide." Again, quote, "I call the New World Order the Fourth Reich, where anti-Semitic thinking becomes acceptable under the guise of saving people in the Middle East. People will also look at all the Jewish power leaders that conspiracies point to, not realizing not only are they not practicing Jews, but they are not the puppet masters." Again, quote, "The protocols of Zion are also blamed on the Jews, but in actuality it is this Vatican core, which includes the Jesuits." And again, "Many think tanks where Illuminati members planned how religion in the New Age movement could be used to create a one religion under false Christianity. There are also many evangelists that are Illuminati as well as New Age leaders." Now, I think that these statements are a warning
mm-hmm.
for us, and we should listen up. Because this certainly appears to be what is going on as much as I can see. And then there's another one of my life experiences that strongly shapes my perception of reality that I'd like to share with the PID audience.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to describe a trip of mine to Israel in 1994. And I got to tour all over Israel, and it was just wonderful. I did a lot of tent camping, and I was able to visit a little town in the mountains of Galilee called Safed. And it's also known as Zephet, and this town is located a little northwest of Lake Galilee up in the mountains. It is famous for its history as the center of Kabbalism in Israel, extending back to medieval times and even before. And Isaac Luria comes to mind as a medieval Kabbalist who was famed for the town of Safed. And while I was there, I happened to stop in the Lubavitcher Center, the Chabad Lubavitcher Center, and I saw posted on the bulletin board there the dust jacket of Rabbi Michael Drazen's book, Their Hollow Inheritance, and I give a link to that book at my website. I learned that he was living there in the town of Safed, and he is a native Californian, and I expressed interest in his book. And at first, I didn't know what the book was about, and I mistook it as one of the kind of books that exposes paganity in Christianity. But boy, I was sure wrong. The book wasn't into all what I thought it was. I went and had purchased a copy after I had talked with him, met with him, and it turned out to be they are pretty unhappy with the Christian proselytizing. Boy, they are anxious to no longer be touched by proselytizing.
Now, they meaning the Lubavitchers, the Kabbalists?
Oh, yeah. They are very resentful of Christians trying to present Christianity to them. Very resentful. Anyway, after I learned that the Lubavitcher people saw that I was interested in Michael's book, one of the people there called him on the phone and said, "Hey, you want to come over and talk to this guy?" And so I got to talking with them about a whole range of topics. And they, the Lubavitchers are Kabbalists. And since this includes the concept of reincarnation, one of the first questions that I asked him is, you know, how could this Eastern Indian Hindu belief be consistent with Torah, the Bible?
Mm-hmm.
The first five books, and I don't remember all that he said, but he pointed out that Abraham had had sons by his wife after Sarah died, and that these sons of Abraham migrated to India and became the Indian people and took with them a belief system from that Abrahamic era of time that included the concept of reincarnation. Of course, mm-hmm. we wouldn't agree with that, but that's their take on the thing.
Mm.
Michael's book is very strong on the concept that King Messiah will soon come to Israel, and indeed they are just pining away for this with all their hearts. And much of his book relates to the time period in the future when, in Israel, King Messiah will finally reign. And I mentioned to him that my ancestry goes back on my mother's side to an Itzhak and Sarah Doherty, who had been Irish Jews in the 1800s. And since Jewishness is reckoned according to matrilineal ancestry, I believe myself to be at least in part a Jew, although obviously I've been brought up as a Gentile, and I was telling him this. And his reaction to this was very strong. He became very insistent on my behalf, even agitated, and insisted that I see the wisdom of proving my Jewishness by establishing for certain my ancestry. And he told me that if I wished to survive well in the time of King Messiah's reign, it would be very good for me, that I would get along in life a lot easier if I were established as a pedigreed Jew. In other words, this was very clear from what he was saying. If I were a proven Jew, that I would survive the politics of this coming era of time quite a bit more easily.
In other words, the implication being that those who are not Jews would not survive
yes,
to remain King Messiah.
Absolutely.
Huh.
So thinking back on this, you know, I continue to be just amazed at his fervor of his insistence about this topic. And he also, you know, in his book also describes what life would be like under the Noahide laws, which for the Lubavitcher Hasidic Jews, they strongly promote this as law for the world. I think most of us in our community recall that George Bush Sr. was responsible in his term for putting the Noahide laws into law here in the United States. And this is a good topic for people to do internet research on. And further, you know, he insisted that I go to, down at the at Temple Mount, the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall.
Mm-hmm.
At the north end of this, there are three cave-like structures. And he wanted me to go see a rabbi there. And he insisted that I would go there and have a phylactery tied to my forehead, and that I would undergo the oath of a Jew. So I thought that was an interesting thing that he should be concerned about.
Mm.
So I purchased a copy of his book in Safed, and much of it's written in a very fervent attitude with respect to the coming of King Messiah. And I hope this is interesting as anecdotal material about this whole topic. Now, I should add that Michael was trying to be a friend of mine, and I should not cast him as a villain, and I don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
He and most all of the Jews just simply don't realize that Jesus Christ is who he says he is.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
exactly.
I don't want to be too hard on these people.
Well, did they leave you to believe that King Messiah is alive now?
Yes, he did. And I think that was a little less hazy at that point in time. And just this past year, King Messiah, by the Kabbalists in Israel, has now been declared by a number of high-ranking Kabbalists to be present and alive in the Holy Land.
That's very, very strange, because when after you sent us this note last night saying that you wanted to mention this as well today, Derek and I did some research on the Lubavitchers, and the word Lubavitch comes from a small town in Belarus, which was where a lot of these Russian Orthodox Jews came from, and then a lot of them settled around New York, and they have, you know, branches throughout the world, and they had various leaders, rabbis, throughout the years, and the one named Menachem Mendel Schneerson died in 1994, but shortly before his death, he was proclaimed to be King Messiah.
Yes, he was.
Are they saying he has resurrected?
Well, you know, I wondered about that, too, or I wonder if they have a new candidate. I don't know, but I know about a year ago There was a lot of talk coming out of the Kabbalists in Israel that King Messiah was now known to be in the land, and then just 3-4 months ago again, a very old man, a Kabbalist, and he's since died, and I think he was something like 103, and he was saying that he had met King Messiah and talked with him, and that the time of his unveiling to the world was very soon in the future. And so they're talking about something.
That is so chilling. Well, you know, again, with the Chabad Lubavitch, which Chabad is Chabad, and it's apparently 3 Jewish letters that form an acronym that stands for wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Now, this goes back all the way to that very first temptation in the garden.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to give you special knowledge. This is very Kabbalistic, very Gnostic.
Yes, it is Gnostic.
Mm. And, you know, and I can't help but think about Christ's admonition to John in Revelation 3 when he's having John write down this letter to the Church of Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
And he says, let me just find it here really quickly. I lost my place. But he says to them that he knows, here it says, behold, I will make, first he says, I know thy works. Behold, I've set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it, for thou hast a little strength, and hast kept my word, and hast not denied my name. Behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, who say that they are Jews, and are not, but do lie. Behold, I'll make them to come and worship before your feet, and to know that I have loved you.
And in the early chapters of Revelation, we're told this not once, but twice.
Yeah, and this is the opposite of what they told you.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Jesus told us in John 5:43 that I am come in my Father's name, and you receive me not. Mm-hmm. He was speaking to the Jews. And if another shall come in his own name, him ye will receive. And so I think that's interesting advance information. We know that whoever it is, that they'll come in their own name. We know that for a fact.
Well, and this is really interesting. And this, again, is just coming at the whole prophetic picture in the timeline that's laying open before us from a completely different perspective. As Christians, we tend to take a very... I don't want to say a narrow view, but we tend to focus on our own scriptures and not really pay attention to the teachings of the groups outside of mainstream Christianity or outside of evangelical Christianity when uh-huh. analyzing a prophecy. For example, what the Kabbalistic Jews are teaching, what the Buddhists are teaching, what the Hindus are teaching, what the Muslims are teaching,
mm-hmm.
and considering that as a spiritual war that there are forces that are laying this information out in front of various groups of people around the world and drawing connections and conclusions and seeing what the relationship is between these various bodies of mm-hmm. prophetic literature.
They're all telling the same story, but it's all with their own individual twist.
Right, right.
Sure.
It is so significant that, you know, you've got the group here, the Lubavitchers, that are promoting the acceptance of the Noahide law amongst mm-hmm. the Gentiles, which again is placing us back under law. Right.
Which Christ fulfilled.
Which
we're no
Christ
longer under
fulfilled.
The law.
Yeah, in fact, actually, the Noahide laws aren't even biblical at all.
No, they're not.
In January of this year, the reconstituted Sanhedrin established a high Noahide council comprised of 10 men who are non-Jews, which includes, Vendel Jones, the guy
right.
who
mm-hmm.
was the inspiration
yes.
for the character of Indiana Jones in the
exactly.
movies. Who, by the way, was supposed to come up with the Ark of the Covenant last
right.
August.
They claim they're about ready to unveil the Ark.
Yeah, they were supposed to, unveil it last year.
Well, either has it and is saving it
maybe
for a special
for June
day.
6th.
Well, somebody's put the brakes on it.
You know, I need to ask you a question.
Uh-huh.
Something that I think many of our listeners may be a little fuzzy on. There are a lot of web pages, a lot of organizations that talk about the Zionists this and that, and that the Zionists are in charge and the Zionists are trying to run the world. And all too often, Zionists are confused with Hebrew people, the people of God,
yes, right.
the Jewish people. Could you please explain that difference for us?
Well, it's a subtle and fine difference. You know, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion purports to expose a Jewish conspiracy. And I think that's nonsense, but when you read the protocols, it's obvious that this is the agenda that's being pursued, and so you know that somebody's doing this. And I hate to see it labeled Zionist. But then on the other hand, you know, you have to confront the reality of the fact that the government in Israel is not a very nice entity.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do with this? I don't know.
You know, it wasn't a nice entity at the time of King Ahab and a lot of the other kings.
No, they weren't.
I mean, they don't have a really good history for a very, you know, noble government.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Zionist thing, it really, really blends off into the whole Masonic thing, too. And we know that there is an extremely important archetype in Freemasonry, and it's probably the most important of all of their archetypes, and that's the raising to life of Hiram Abiff, gravely injured by the ruffians. Mm-hmm. And this raising of the widow's son is central to the Masonic myth, and this certainly jibes with the Bible, in as much as the Antichrist will be raised to life from a severe head wound. And we should recall that both Elijah and Jesus raised to life sons of widows.
Mm-hmm.
And further, the Bible in Zechariah 11:17 tells us, "Woe to the idle shepherd that leaveth the flock. The sword shall be upon his arm and upon his right eye, and his arm shall be clean dried up, and his right eye shall be utterly darkened." This ties in with the dust jacket on the recently published Secrets of the Code by Dan Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And on the dust jacket, you can read the little portion that's written there, and it's on his website about that topic, Dan Brown's website. Quote, "But once you find these slightly bolded letters and string them together, they clearly spell out an intriguing question. Is there no help for the widow's son?" So clearly, the world is anticipating this event, and I refer to it as the fulfillment of the Judeo-Masonic imperative, and it's something that has to happen. The Bible says it will, and it will.
You know, it's really interesting. Again, last night we were just madly searching the Internet for things, and when I was learning about this, Rabbi Schneerson, shortly before he died, he had a stroke. And so one side of his body did wither.
Uh-huh.
How interesting. How interesting. And also interesting that one of the fellows who's a leader, well, prophecy of the Islamic Mahdi.
That's
Don't they prophesy that he will be blind
in
one eye?
He will be one-eyed, exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why you had a one-eyed...
Sheikh Omar.
Yeah, exactly. And I think very often the leaders tend to be one-eyed, which, of course, harkens back to Horus.
Horus, yes, absolutely.
Horus, who was the son of a widow.
That's right. This leads all the way back to Babylon, and that's where we're going to go as we continue our discussion with David Duncan as we continue talking prophecy and the 2012 scam next time on PID Radio.
Dave Duncan's website is thenewworldorderscam.com, and once you get there, you'll find a link to his page, The Year 2012 Scam. And it is sort of a 2012
week.
Theme this week.
We've got David Flynn on Thursday and Friday, and he also will be talking about 2012. And, of course, if you've been totally, you know, living elsewhere and not paid any attention to timelines, the Maya calendar, of course, supposedly ends at 2012 in December.
And we'll discuss whether or not that fits into a biblical context with Dave and Dave as Dave Week continues during our prophecy series here. We welcome your comments. We truly do. We've gotten some really interesting feedback on the guests that we've had so far. We get some people who think that, you know, some of the ideas presented are great. We get some that are saying, you know, don't know where you're getting your stuff. And that's fine. That is absolutely fine, because ultimately we have to come back as Christians to the source of truth, which is the Bible. I mean, that is the ultimate arbiter. And we may have different ways of interpreting it, or we may very well have overlooked some things in there that shed new light on things that we think. So we appreciate your comments at radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
That's right. And if you ever want to weigh in on the forum, that's peeringintodarkness.com/forum. We know from Scripture that Jesus' own disciples, the ones that walked and talked with him, they argued about things. So if they were arguing, imagine how we must, you know, a couple of millennia later, looking through glass darkly.
Yeah. That was something that really amazed me when I went through the Bible for the first time and saw in the first chapter of Acts, which is actually where Jesus makes his last appearance, an historical appearance in the Bible, other than the, you know, revelation to John. But 40 days after his resurrection, they're there on the mountain up in Galilee, and the disciples were still asking, okay, are you going to bring back the kingship to Israel now?
Yeah, they didn't quite get it. That'd be great. Hey, so, do I get to be on your right hand or your left hand? Oh, gosh.
So, and isn't it amazing that God used such flawed, as he continues to do today, flawed and confused vessels, people.
You just described us.
I know. That's exactly it. To try
and
to work.
Really, we are peering into darkness, folk. We truly are. Just in case you didn't know, that's what BID stands for. I bet you figured that out, though. Well, we've had a great time. We'll be back tomorrow with part two of the David Duncan interview. And then, of course, on Wednesday, we'll have part three. And if you ever want to go to the archives, you can listen to the old shows. We've interviewed David Duncan before and Dave Flynn, so you might want to catch up for those so you're prepared.
That's right.
And ready this week.
And don't forget the show notes for every program that we do are at the website as well. You find it all at PIDradio.com.
By the way, we don't mention it very often, but we have an affiliate.
Yeah, and I think it's such a hoot because he's located right on the outskirts of Las Vegas.
Uh-huh. Mr. Paul Pilgrim is nice enough to put us on his show nightly. I think it's Monday through Friday.
Monday through Friday. Yep. The Remnant Radio Network, Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. Central Time. That's UTC-5.
Yep. So you can always listen to us being streamed from that source, or you can, as we said, go to the archives, listen online. If you ever have a problem, please send us a note, because we do try to get those things fixed. Sometimes we just put a comma where a period belongs.
Yep. And, well, that's a UCC terminology there, honey. Feel free to download the shows, the MP3 files, and burn them to disk if you like as well. We have no restrictions about that.
Oh, not at all. Please, please. We would like for as many people as possible to hear our guests and what they have to say.
Yeah.
Well, until tomorrow, I'm going to remain Sharon Gilbert.
I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening to PID Radio.
Bye-bye, everybody. Gonna step up to the microphone. Say it loud and clear. A better day.